wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion. This is the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
Who's in the new basement studio by the lake. I am still in our alternate studios by the river because we are still apart due to famine and disease. Oh, not famine, but disease, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm a little peckish, but I'm famine.
And to be fair on this show, we're also going to look at other Earth-ending events. At least we have one coming up at the start of the show.
Yeah, you can't forget about, some of the classics.
But talking of classics, because we actually, to be fair, we actually haven't done a show together in about 5 weeks. Five or six weeks.
Yeah.
The last two shows have all been like sort of edits and cut-ins and stuff like that.
I haven't
that.
Listened to the greatest hits yet either, so.
You haven't?
No.
No. I thought it was quite a good one this year.
I normally do. Somebody emailed me about it and had some commentary, but it wasn't exactly negative. It wasn't positive. It was more of like observational, but okay. I can't remember what they said.
Oh, all right. Anyway. I mean, I must confess it, that the best of shows are always the ones that when someone talks to me or someone I know and they're like, oh, what's your podcast? And you go through a whole thing and then they're like, what should I listen to? And whenever they go, what should I listen to? I'm like, we've done like 150 episodes. I don't know what it means. Like, which one? The greatest ever episode was March 21, 2017. Yeah. So I always tell them, I always say, look, just search for one of the best ofs. Listen to that. Everything is sort of set up for you. And then you hopefully can get a feel for what we are to listen more.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, because we've been apart, we're going to get back into the rhythm. We have a whole load of like sort of shorter topics that we're going to weave through. And talking of disease and famine, the other thing that can wipe us off the face of the earth are, of course, asteroids.
Yes, we have warned people many times. It's coming,
Well, there's one.
You might wish for it, but.
There's one for certain that's coming, but it's not coming for, 14 million years? Apparently, I found a story that the two Indian schoolgirls have discovered an earthbound asteroid after looking through images from a telescope at the University of Hawaii. And apparently, they're able to predict that it will hit Earth in a million years. Now, that being said, and before I let you in, that being said, the asteroid apparently is kind of near Mars. So it's on this big, massive orbit where it's going to disappear into the ether and then return and destroy us all.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, a million years from now, I feel pretty good about it.
What, that we won't be around or we might already be wiped out?
At this point, I'm not even worrying about problems 5 years from now, let alone a million years from now.
Because I guess a million years ago, dinosaurs roamed the Earth. And we do have another.
Right? We did have another asteroid thing before we got to the dinosaurs.
Oh, I do the other asteroid thing.
There was, on August 16th, a car-sized asteroid came within just under 2,000 miles of the planet, making the closest known non-impacting asteroid on record. So this would be bigger. People know about the one in Russia that kind of blew up in the sky and busted a lot of windows and stuff.
Yep.
That was like refrigerator size, if I remember correctly. But this one being car size, this would have been a bigger deal. But it flew close enough to Earth that Earth's gravity significantly changed its orbit. I don't know how far away the moon is. I forget. Sometimes these things are actually within the orbit of the moon.
The moon is a quarter, 200. The moon is 240,000 miles away.
Really?
That's how far. That's the distance. The distance from the Earth to the moon. But for this one came not just between the Earth and the moon.
Oh yeah, it's like really close. 2,000.
When you send me that story, there were two things that struck out to me. One, how close that was, but then I was sort of refreshed that it was the size of a large SUV. So if it was the size of a large SUV, the reality is it would probably get burned up in the atmosphere. But if it was a big monster and it was that close to Earth, we'd be in real trouble.
Yeah, but I mean, a car is big. I mean, considering the one in the one was refrigerator size and did quite a bit of damage because it didn't make it all the way down to the ground. But this is not nothing to sneeze at.
No, and again, it within 2,000 miles. I mean, that's like sort of from here to Denver, from the East Coast of the US to Denver.
Good point.
Yeah, I mean, it's not far away at all. And so, yeah, I'm always a bit surprised that I can't decide if it's an intentional thing by governments to just not bring this up. So you have to find it on the internet. I don't know if that's like sort of news. Like, hey, apparently, something really big really came to hit us.
This is all coming from a Gizmodo article. And apparently the threshold is asteroids that are 460 feet or bigger, which can cause considerable damage if they strike Earth. So I guess they're not too worried about anything. So this is, you're right, pretty small relative to things. You need a football field size one before you really get nervous.
Still, I thought what was interesting, though, from the article is the fact that it came close enough that Earth's gravity kind of deflected it.
They have a little picture, and it's a full, like, the angle the thing makes. You know, it's sort of a bending arc. We've all seen the movies where you kind of slingshot around something, but it's about a, I don't know, 20-degree inflection, I think, in the path it took.
Yeah.
Maybe 30-degree.
So I guess to an extent, too, like Earth's gravity is, like, we always think it, like I said a few minutes ago, well, it, you know, these, they just burn up in the atmosphere. But I would imagine on a super cosmic level, Earth's first line of defense is its gravity. That sort of deflects. Do you know what I mean? It sort of deflects.
Well, it's not deflecting. It's deflecting towards. I was about to say Earth is a little bit like.
Oh, no, you're
bring
right.
Bring
it
on.
Yeah.
Bring it. You know, you're coming close to me. I'll bring you right in here. Come on.
Yeah, okay.
maybe the Earth is sick and tired of us and is inviting the asteroids along and using its gravity to pull them in and just be like, wipe these people out.
The Earth has a death wish. That being said, we do have a tangentially related to Trump story coming up. So if you add asteroids and COVID and Trump, then the death wish thing is probably a real thing there.
Right.
I also sent you an article related to asteroids.
That's
and cool. So if you figure out that the two Indian schoolgirls discovered that one's going to hit us in a million years, well, mm-hmm. then one hit us a million years ago, and that's what wiped out the dinosaurs. And
yeah,
I found this website.
Factor.
Sorry, right. Go ahead.
It's a Life Hacker thing. Well, I guess Life Hacker had the article and said, like, use this map to find out which dinosaurs lived in your area by Elizabeth Yuko. And it has a website. And people have all seen, like, where they take – once upon a time, there was a big continent, Pangaea, and they use, like, maps. Like, so you can tell that, for example, South America and Africa, the coastlines kind of match up. And
okay.
So it's kind of like if you squish them up. Obviously, there's lots of soil moving around. So you see versions of the maps that basically overlay current maps to kind of give you a sense of which land was at which point. It's really based on the continental plates. But the map, like this thing, you put them where you are, and then it goes through like all these different – it's not just dinosaur times. It goes way back, way, way, way back about like what was going on
right.
at the time. But – to my mind, I couldn't – it just seemed like it was describing what was going on Earth. It didn't really – like it wasn't like what's in your backyard.
Yeah,
you know, like it talked about like, oh, you know, there's things in the oceans, there aren't things in the oceans. But it never was like, well, and where you are, it's X. So I don't really know how they came up with this version of an article coming out of this item.
I did feel that the article was a little bit of bait and switch because the headline said – click on this neat graphic to find out what dinosaurs lived where you are. So mm-hmm. I immediately open the article and I'm typing in my zip code because I'm hoping to see, ooh, Tyrannosaurus Rex lived around
exactly.
here. Or wow, the really other big one. And mm-hmm. then, so I typed something in and then I sort of clicked into this sort of long description about what Earth looked like during that time. And I'm like, that's interesting, but I want to know what dinosaurs were roaming the neighborhood before I roamed it.
Yeah.
And so I felt, like I said, I felt like the article was a slight bait and switch, but we will link it in the blog post. And if any of you can figure out how to work it, let us know. Because I do want to know what dinosaurs lived around here.
Well, I'm like clicking through again now, but it is the same thing, but I really never got like it. It's claims that if you put stuff in, it lists specific dinosaurs that fossils are nearby you. But I never found that.
And that's
it's still sort of interesting just to see like and you kind of you think of dinosaurs as being around forever. But the era in which they were in was actually fairly narrow. You know, I mean, it's more time than we've been around. But it's not like they've been around since the beginning of history. A bunch of the first levels, it's like what's in your neighborhood? A gaseous, mess, well, kind of thing.
And then here's the thing, too. From the article, I do get a sense that, and I know this is going to sound really obvious as soon as I say it. Like, even now on Earth, there are certain animals that only live in certain parts of the world, for whatever reason. And so I'm guessing, too, that for the dinosaurs, it was sort of the same way. That being said, to your point, whenever we think about dinosaurs and we think of long ago, we just think of it all as one big neighborhood where everything looked the same. Do you know what I mean? Like, we never think of, now, you wouldn't get a polar bear living in Africa. So I'm sure, by extension, there were probably some species of dinosaurs that lived in, that maybe lived in some of the colder regions, but didn't live in the super hot where the volcanoes were going off.
I mean, there had to be differences, right? Like, that's what I thought we would get information on. So first dinosaurs were 220 million years ago, and then they disappeared 66 million years ago. So they had a good run. But this history, this thing goes back to 750 million years ago. So three times as long as these dinosaur stuff is. So
yeah. Well. And so yeah.
Wait, introduce something that we're not quite sure. Is it very interesting?
It was interesting to me. Right, and again, I would imagine if you listen to this show, again, talking of people listening to the pod, if you listen to this show, I'd like to think you probably have a passing interest in dinosaurs.
Because
if you're still listening after all these years of us banging on about asteroids, then really, what you can't do is sit there and go, here they go talking about that thing again. That's the show. So we're going to move through a whole load of other news stories, stuff that came up.
This has got a science bent, although it won't sound like it initially. I'd sent you an article. People have probably seen these flotillas of supporters of Trump on boats.
Okay.
Calling them Trump-tillas. They actually had one on the Potomac 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I figure in D.C. it's a hard place to get it. But, these people managed to strap an awful lot of flags on their boats.
Yeah.
So this article's in the Financial Times, their Alphaville section. If, for some reason, when I try to click the link, it seems to suggest you have to register. But if you just Google boats and I'll give you something at the end because it'll give away what part of the story is here. But they're basically saying, listen, we're not going to talk about whether this is a good thing or not. But there's one in this call came from the one in Texas where a number of the boats got swamped and sank and people had to be rescued.
Right.
And so what this person was explaining is most modern boats, and they're talking about the technology boats, are really, you can only do this if you all go really fast or you all go really slow. Because boat hulls, there's two basic types of boat hulls. There's a displacement hull and a planing hull.
Okay.
And a planing hull is when you get up to speed, essentially is skimming across the water. Like it's got enough of a contour to the bottom so that it pushes it up and it planes. And you kind of know this
like a speedboat.
When you see it. Yeah, yeah. But it doesn't even have to be like a total speedboat to do a lot of fishing boats. When they get up to speed, they're planing.
Okay.
And then when they come down to speed, they're essentially acting as a displacement, like a ship, like a military ship. Is almost always a displacement hull. The boat doesn't rear up out of the water, go down, it just goes, and it's a lot more energy to push through the water with a displacement hull, which is why people have these boats that do planing. But the trick with that is if you have a planing hull and you go kind of a decent speed, but not too fast, so it's sitting down in the water.
You're neither one thing or the other.
Much bigger wake.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, so you make a big wake.
Okay. And
that's why if you're all flying along jets, it does obviously makes a wake, but it's big enough that the other boats around can handle it. Whereas if you're all going in that or if you go really slow, so you're barely making a wake, that's fine too. But if you go this sort of medium speed, I think they said it's 10 knots or something like that, you just create so many waves and everybody's in a group there that all their waves are building on each other and they swamp each other. So that's the science lesson of if you're going to run a Trump tiller.
Because again, when I saw some of the pictures, I'm my first thought was, because to your point, when you see the pictures, it looks like there are these massive waves. And my first point was, don't be going out. It doesn't matter which presidential candidate you support. Don't be going out on a boat on a day like this. I mean, I remember that. I think it was only like two
years. Creating the waves. Well, there was a bit of waves are there already, but a lot of them are there creating their own problems.
Well, that was the thing. It was only later when I realized that basically these massive waves were actually self-created by the Trump tiller.
Yeah.
And I was surprised that if you've got a boat, I am surprised that you don't know these things. But I guess getting a boat, like anyone, I could get a boat, and I wouldn't have known that.
Yeah, I mean, there's some people get way into their boats, and they figure all these details out, and other folks are like, well, it's a boat, you know. Especially, you know, this thing makes a joke that, like, suggesting that Democrats are more sailboat people and Republicans are more these motorboat people, which is a total generalization that does not really hold true. But you know, you could just pop it in the water if it's a motorboat, right? Like, it's like a sailboat. You have to, like, learn a bunch of the things in order to know what you're doing. Whereas a motorboat, you can learn all of it, but you don't really have to, you know, you just put it in there, especially if you're dropping in a lake. They may not even really require much of a certification. In the open water, you probably got to get some training to be able to have your stuff out there.
If you do go to the internet and you actually look for pictures of this, the boats, you know, because it was a tiller, in this instance, a Trump tiller. I mean, obviously the boats are completely decked out. Like, each boat has like 8 or 9 or 10 or 12 flags.
Yeah. I think they must be using like the fish, you know, when you go on a big fishing boat it has all spots for rods. So you can run along with like 8 or 10 rods hanging out.
But my question is, if you have a whole load of flags, would that in any way?
Certainly a decent amount of drag.
Yeah. So that too might have contributed to this whole notion.
Sure.
I mean, again, I go to the Christmas boat parade in the area that I live here every Christmas. Mm-hmm. They have a Christmas boat parade where people chug down the Potomac and on their boat, and they show off their lights and decorations. But it's all very low speed. People are playing music, and instead of, you know, it's like a whole load of flashing lights going by because people have put like a blow up Santa Claus on their boat and this sort of thing. You know, I've seen that, but again, that's not creating. You know, if you run around outside the house with a massive towel, you know, above your head, you'd feel the drag in your arms. So I would imagine that even if you're on a boat, if you've got, you know, 9 or 10 big, you know, 6 by 10 foot flags, that's also going to create, it's going to rock your boat side to side, and to your point, it's going to create more waves and.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think basically what happened here was a whole load of science deniers ignored the science and got into trouble.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole, we're not going to go down that path. Everybody, you know, the relationship between politics and science these days.
Yes.
Keeping with transportation, you sent an article, so I'll let you introduce this one.
So I sent an article that I found on, and I actually don't have, where did I find it? I think it was on
the drive.com.
TheDrive.com, but basically it talked about how Airbus, which is sort of the European jet manufacturer, they're, you know, Boeing are the big American one, and then Airbus are the big sort of joint European one, although I'm not sure if that's going to actually include Britain anymore as we're out of Europe. They are redesigning the center console of their A350, and I think the A350 is sort of, I don't know. I tend to know my Boeings kind of offhand. I don't know what the A350 is, sort of a pretty big medium range.
I don't recognize it. It's got like they have a picture of it in its Airbus, like it's not tied to a particular airline, but it's got sort of a belly to it, if that makes, like where the wings are, instead of being a straight fuselage, it kind of has a little swollen lump underneath it, as if it was sort of has a pot belly or something like that.
Yeah, I mean it's two engines, but so, it is not. It can fly, it's basically the kind of jet. It's not like a 737. It is a much bigger jet that can go. You know, airlines use it for like, you know, medium to long haul flights. So we're talking about a pretty sizable jet here, and you know, it comes to mind, it doesn't really matter what size the jet is, but apparently. They had to redesign the center console because pilots were putting their coffee down on it and spilling coffee on the equipment.
There's apparently two incidents in the past 8 months.
Yes.
where they became a problem. And interestingly enough, you would say, okay, it's obviously not good if you spill 30 instruments, but how bad could the situation be? So a couple of your gauges go out. No, well, it turns out actually it knocked out the engine.
Yes.
Somehow in doing this. And they comment in this, by the way, the first one was Asiana Airlines. And to be fair, it supposedly was tea that was spilled on the instrument panel, not coffee. So but it's more, you know, conventional to say the coffee. And one of the Rolls-Royce Trent XWB engines abruptly shut down soon after the spill, and they had to land. So that's kind of a big deal, right?
Like, yeah.
I'm not quite sure why the engine should shut down because you spilled something. If I spilled something in the dashboard of my car, I'm pretty sure it would keep running. You know,
well, like although if you spill something on, put it this way, if any of us dropped our phone in water, we would panic, right? That would be the instant reaction to, oh no, I've dropped my phone in the wash basin, and we would panic. We'd be grabbing the jar of rice to throw to desperately try and, you know, and your head is full of all those thoughts. Like,
oh, you're making an Asian comment,
right? No, I mean, that's what you do when you wet your phone, you put it in rice. But I don't know if that works or not, but that's what everyone does. But we would all be panicking like, oh no, I've got to get a new phone. So what I'm saying is I think we all are at some level aware of the fact that you shouldn't be spilling any of this sort of stuff on your computer or any of that kind of thing. And ultimately, you know, these new planes, the cockpit is basically a big computer system.
Yeah, I imagine that's what the real problem is somehow it changes what the gauges and computers are saying, and it turns off the engine because it's confused, or the computer. Like we've talked before about some of the problems with these computer focused airline systems, where they kind of can do things that they become uncooperative. They're sort of like a malfunctioning
engine. And so if you can imagine, you know, you can imagine it's the space between, you know, but if you sit in your car, it's the space between you and who's sitting in the passenger seat. So it's that big area in between. And to be fair, when you look at pictures, it was a big, flat, very inviting area to put your coffee down. But here's the issue, which I thought was more interesting. There are cup holders designed into the cockpit.
Oh, really?
Apparently, some pilots had already reported that the cup holders that Airbus had put into the cockpit were too small. So that's why. So people were acknowledging, you know, because obviously on a modern plane.
So maybe the real fix isn't like about the center console. It's just about bigger cup holders.
Bigger cup holders. Well, that was the thing. So it would appear that Airbus now are redesigning the whole area. They're gonna make bigger cup holders so that pilots. And you know, it's kind of funny that it's not, but let's face it, why is it any different for a pilot on a 7-hour flight that when he's in the middle of doing nothing for 6 hours, why can't he drink his coffee sitting at, you know what I mean? We do it in our cars. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to sit here and go, aren't these dudes supposed to go in the back? I mean, they sit in the front and eat their dinner and all that type of thing. And clearly the cockpit was designed that way, but it would appear that the cup holders they designed were too small. So all these pilots, I guess a testament to how smooth the plane is, were then putting their coffee on this console in the middle, and then, hey presto, they were knocking over their coffee or tea, and engines were shutting down, and planes were making emergency landings. And as someone who doesn't like to fly, I've sort of tried to mount a defense of pilots, but I'm like, goodness me, what's going on up there?
Well, I'm actually going to be on a conference call with a friend of mine who's a pilot of large jets, so I'll have to ask him about that.
Well, I mean, you ask him about that. Ask him where he, you know, did. Because again, I don't know. On short haul flights now, like when, because I only ever fly international, and when you sit on the plane, you know, you always have that. You know, you get your tray, and because it's designed a certain way, you know, the little serving dishes are kind of awkward to cut into, but the coffee cups are always designed kind of funny, because they don't want them tipping over. So I'm curious if the captain and the first officer, do they use those?
Or they just grab Starbucks?
Yeah, or do they just bring their Starbucks cup and they sort of slam that down and whatever it may be. So anyway, the good thing is Airbus are now sticking warnings. They're redesigning the whole kit and caboodle. They're also giving those safety notices that go out to everyone, basically saying, please don't put your coffee on the center console.
They did those little handprint like stickers that you put on, or not handprint, but like little machine print. What are those things called? Those plastic ones that you used to have to squeeze each time, and it indented the letters into the plastic tape.
Dymo.
Yeah.
Is that what they were?
It's something like that. You know,
yeah,
like
Dynamo or Dymo or something. You know, yeah. The Dallas Cowboys always use them on their helmets. Here's a bit of trivia for you. Go back and watch like late 70s or early 80s NFL and watch Cowboys games. They identified everyone's helmets because they used that little plastic Dymo thing. Mm-hmm. It's like a handheld thing with a big round.
Yeah, it had a sort of a plastic wheel, and you would slide, you go each letter, and then you'd turn a dial to the letter, and you'd squeeze it. And what it did is it like stretched the plastic. So the one I had blue tape, and it would stretch it so it was white. It would make a white letter because, like, you know, when you scratch, it's kind of like if you bend a piece of plastic, it loses that color.
That Dymo, it was DYMO. They were label makers. That was basically what they were. And it would make their first design would make that look strip of plastic. And then I think you would cut it, or it had the little handheld machine gizmo had a cutter on it. And then you'd still have to peel the back and then stick it to whatever you were sticking it to. So stick it on your computer or your bag, or if you were a 1970s Dallas Cowboy, it would be stuck to the back of your helmet.
DYMO. They're still in business. They seem to make a lot of more, obviously, compute little miniature printers instead of the plastic thing. But I wonder if you can find one of those plastic things just for like retro art or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's still a use for them, because, I mean, they were quite, it was super, like it was heavy juicy. It was heavy duty adhesive on the back. Like once you stuck it down to something, if you found that you'd stuck it in the wrong place, you basically had to get the equivalent of a razor blade to get it up and off. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't like it wasn't just like a peel away, like label that you'd make out of your printer or anything. It was some pretty heavy duty plastic that once you stuck down, that was pretty good. That was pretty hardy.
Yeah. All right. Like, so you can still get an embossing label maker from Container Store.
How much is that as you're looking?
$11.99.
Okay. I mean, it was one of those things when I was a kid. I remember when my mom always had them in her office at work. Everyone had them, and they used them to mark files and filing cabinets. Because you could, again, it would produce. And I actually think they were like, you could buy different size sort of width tape, but each tape you needed to have the separate size, like sort of gizmo.
Uh-huh.
That was the issue. So if you wanted to use like a 1-inch, if you wanted to print on a 1-inch tape, you had to have a 1-inch tape gizmo machine. Mm-hmm. But the standard one was about 5 or 6 millimeters across. And like I say, once you had your little label, you would then peel the back, and whatever you stuck it to, I mean, it would stay in there unless you get a knife or something to scrape it off. So it was a pretty hardcore product.
All right.
Next flying story.
Yeah, more flying thing, and it kind of connects to our asteroids too, because we talked about a car-sized asteroid.
Yes.
Well, home state of the science advisor to the pod, New Hampshire, has legalized, or at least set up a legal framework for flying cars, for driving flying cars on public highways. As the article, and this is another one that was in the drive, although it links out to a Mass Live article, and they say, are there any street legal aircrafts currently in production? No, there are not. But there is a company, I guess, in the Boston area that's working on it. And I suspect, this doesn't have anything about the politics, but a lot of times when you have that, you have somebody who can get the ear, and it wouldn't be surprising if Boston was like, well, there's no chance I'm going to get New Hampshire to cooperate. I mean, sorry, I'm going to get Massachusetts to cooperate with this. So I go my nearby state here where they might cut me a little break so that we can make plans for testing things out there. It's kind of like with the self-driving cars, where I think they've gotten some favorable legislation in various places to allow them to test things out.
So the interesting thing, though, that, and this is the thing, it wasn't just like it was to allow the flying car to drive on the road,
right?
Because they still didn't really have, they don't really yet have workable flying cars. There wasn't any point sort of clearing the legislation for the thing to fly. But I would assume that the first step is, you know, you can You can drive your flying car on the road and not get a ticket for having something that may not look like everything else that's on the road.
Oh yeah, so I went to the Mass Live article. So the company is Terrafugia. A Woburn-based builder flying cars is among the private sector companies that have been working with legislators and policymakers before the signing of the bill. It's founded in 2006 by some MIT grads. And apparently they do have some prototype. I guess there's some video when you go there. I don't know if it's real or not, but it kind of looks like things from James Bond. Like it looks like a plane and yes. Like the wings kind of fold out and apparently like driving down a runway, folding out its wings as it goes and taking off. But I imagine actually doing it on that road might be a little more complicated.
I saw one that there's one called the Switchblade, I think. And so it's got a propeller behind what looks like a sort of a cross between a car cabin and a small light aircraft cabin. But I think it looks like a small aircraft cabin, but it has wing mirrors on it. So if you are driving around on the road, you can see who's behind you. But I'm guessing the whole point is, well, okay, you can drive this thing around now. And then when you get the flight, when they actually produce these things that can fly, then that's actually, as I saw in one article, that would be the FAA would have to get involved in that.
Right.
So it would no longer be a state thing.
I guess. I mean, well, I don't. Yeah, probably that's all federally regulated when you think about it. Even FAA was the ones who did the rules on drones and stuff. So probably once you get off the ground, it's a federal.
Talking of drones, do you need to get a license to own a drone?
It's not a license, but I think obviously a lot of people, it's not like you can't buy one without doing it, but technically you're supposed to register them. And I think they're supposed to, if they're built properly and the companies that make them are licensed, they have some sort of identification number so that they can figure out, you know, what happened to them if something goes wrong. So and of course, around here, you're not allowed to fly them at all close to the Capitol. I forget how many miles out, but basically everything in the close in counties in Virginia is you're not supposed to be flying them at all because it's supposed to be too close to the Capitol.
Because I'm trying to think it wouldn't be. I mean, there's a part of me thinks it should be like a fishing license. Do you know what I mean?
And it might be. I mean, it's not like a license where you have to prove some knowledge or something like that. Right. It's really just so that they can keep track of who's got them and who's making mistakes. I guess there was some story was in California where the pilot saw somebody on a jetpack or claimed that somebody was flying around.
Someone
on a
coming in
to land
nearby
the airport.
Yeah, claimed they saw someone fooling around on a jetpack near the airport. And I don't know what it is about people. I don't know whether it's like some sort of thing. Like if I've built a jetpack, why on earth do I want to be flying around near the airport?
No.
I mean, again, like I understand that if I'm in a plane, I'm already worried about the pilot spilling coffee on the controls, but now I'm worried about the pilot trying to avoid a drone, but also a jetpack. But I'm also thinking, if I'm actually the dude on a jetpack.
Yeah, you lose that one. It's not.
Yeah, why do I want to be flying around near like 747s or whatever it may be? It seems a bit odd. It's like that famous Top Gear thing where they. Do you ever see that episode of Top Gear where they tested to see if a big jet with its engines going on the ground could blow away a car?
Mm-hmm.
And I think they did that. It showed up in one of the James Bond movies where the car behind gets caught in the jet wash and it goes flying, tumbling away across the airport. Well, I would imagine if I'm just a dude on a jetpack, I'm excited. I've got my jetpack. I'm showing off. I'm boasting to my buddies. Everyone's going, hey, did you hear about Zeph? He's got a jetpack. Why on earth am I down at the airport? Really, who am I kidding?
Yeah.
Unless you're like, what was that movie from like the 90s? It's set in the 1930s, like a superhero movie. The dude is like a superhero who has a jetpack. Yeah. And he's got like that really funky looking 1930s helmet. And it's all got, I think the Nazis are in it. And all this, the Rocketeer. Yeah. I don't know. It seems a bit odd. Like, I understand people taking their drone down to the airport and doing a bit of low-grade terrorism, but putting yourself up there in a jetpack, that's a whole different level.
It seems like a
mistake. That's like kamikaze pilot level to be up there in a jetpack messing with the planes. But anyway, it would appear that in New Hampshire now, you're going to be able to drive that thing about.
Sure, why not?
I just... I mean, I guess it's coming, right? Apparently.
Mm-hmm. The article makes the joke that the Jetsons, you know, the Jetsons cartoon was set in 2062. So really not that far off, right?
Not that far off. Okay, let's move on. Actually, talking of cars, I have a segue before the next story you're going to hit us with.
Okay.
So I read something online, and if I find it, I'll link this in the blog. A couple of comedians got stopped for sitting in a Tesla and drinking and partying while the Tesla was in what do you call it when it driving itself mode?
Oh, I don't know. Autopilot.
It's got a cute name, yeah. But here's the thing. No one was sitting behind the wheel. And I guess the whole part of the thing is they're trying to claim that they shouldn't get a ticket because they weren't. No one was drunk driving behind the wheel.
Driver, right? Who's guilty of anything at that point?
So the point is, well, you can do me for being an idiot, but you can't do me for drunk driving, I guess was sort of the argument they made.
Tesla, it comes up on their TMZ, the first thought. Idiots use it as a designated driver flying down the highway, and they do look like they're pretty drunk. And shock of shock, the first picture, there's the White Claw. And maybe this is like the other thing might be a can of Four Loko.
which one is that?
Four Loko was the one that a bunch of years ago was like, it's like super duper caffeinated. And then they still make it, but it's like, it's been lightened up. Yeah, it is Four Loko. White Claw, truly. Four Loko, Natty Light Seltzer all over the car. The amount of caffeine it had was sort of like dangerous amounts or something. And so they got in some trouble and they moderated their recipe, but it's like some malt beverage kind of junk. Mountain Dew liquor or something like that.
What do you know off the top of your head what a dangerous amount of caffeine is? Like, could you sort of convert that into cups of coffee?
I think it was like a 5 cups. I'm making it up, but I don't remember. Okay.
But having all that in just one drink is now dangerous.
I think, the thing is that especially, or maybe it wasn't even 5, maybe the problem was, you know, when people have drinks, they don't just have one, you know, you might have 6. And so, you know, you're really cranking up your caffeine level.
You know, if that's what the dude was drinking, I cannot decide if I was like the traffic court judge, I cannot decide if in fact his defense is pretty sound. Because if you drink that much caffeine and you're behind the wheel, you're just as much of a menace as A, the car on autopilot, or B, the dude that Maya had 3 or 4 beers. I mean, you know, and I don't mean to... I'm not trying to sort of talk light about something quite serious, but I'm one of those people. I actually limit my caffeine. No, limit is the wrong word. I just don't overdo it. But on a morning where I've pounded 4 cups of coffee at the diner in a short amount of time, I'm definitely feeling it, you know, for an hour after type thing. So I cannot decide if, you know, maybe that's to Tesla's core audience. That, hey, fight over caffeination by using our autopilot mode.
Yeah, the original version, I'm looking at the Four Loko Wikipedia, the original version had taurine, guarana, caffeine, and wormwood, which, of course, is supposed to be what's in absinthe. It's a bit of a goof. Apparently, it was a bunch of guys who were students at Ohio State, and in their fraternity, they used to make up, you know, punches and stuff. But in 2009, a group of U.S. state attorneys general began an investigation of the company. A bunch of companies are doing caffeinated alcohol being marketed to teenagers, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so.
No, but that does segue into the article you sent me.
So Bud Light, people may or may not remember that Budweiser had a series of platinum. Maybe it was Bud Light Platinum, or, you know, it was supposed to be nicer versions of their regular beers, and I don't think it really did very well. But they're rolling out, you know, we know they have Bud Light Seltzers, which not only are, you know, I've seen a number of the reviews since we did ours. There's an episode people can start with. They can listen to all us tasting all the seltzer flavors. But a number of reviews have said good things about them. Like, in the world of seltzers, the Bud Light Seltzers are considered to be pretty good. Or at least some of the flavors. Well, now they've got a platinum seltzer. They're doing blood orange, wild berry, and citrus, and this is 8% alcohol. And from what I remember, I think the regular stuff tends to be in the mid-4s, kind of like.
Yeah, 4. I think the highest we tested was like 6.
Maybe a little bit more than your average light beer, but not like craft beer level, not 8%. And They have a dark blue can. And like, so this is, again, one of those cases where I have a feeling some people from a marketing perspective are thinking more dudes will have this. Yeah. Of course, what they found originally, and the other things that a lot of the stories were about, how despite the fact that a lot of the seltzer makers thought they were really maybe marketing originally to women, they found it was pretty non-gender specific, and so they kind of dropped that idea. So I don't know what they're after. I mean, like, listen, they're just basically after people getting more of a buzz for their stuff. I mean, it's not – you're not going to get any difference in like, at least in like craft beers and stuff, the higher alcohol and stuff usually comes with greater recipes, greater flavors, different ingredients put in there. I think when you get an 8% seltzer, it's just an 8% seltzer instead of a 4.5% seltzer. It's not going to be like, oh, well, this one tastes much better because they allowed it to develop more alcohol signature to it.
Well, I want to pick on a point that you made there about, and we did have this discussion. If you go back, I think it was in March when we did we road tested a whole load of these hard seltzers.
Yep.
I think to your point that marketers originally felt that the product was going to be aimed at females rather than young men. But I think ultimately what has sort of happened, and I'm going to tie this back to this notion of Blood Like Platinum, is that it has found a home with the youth market. And so what I'm saying is the notion of Bud Light Platinum, that it sort of sounds a bit like, is this a way to maybe age up the seltzer?
Maybe.
And do you know what I mean? To make it appeal, yeah. Hey, someone like me, I think I might have a Blood Like Platinum because I'm not actually, do you know what I mean?
Apparently the slogan is brewed for the night.
Yes.
And this so notion maybe, of brewed. Like, I do think like the seltzers are probably the regular ones, the white cans and all have a little bit of a afternoon picnic outdoor kind of right. Drinking vibe to them versus like what you're going to have at 11 o'clock in the bar.
Right.
So maybe that's what they're trying to do, is pick up some folks that would order it in a bar.
And it's interesting that they use the word brewed there.
They just brewed. I mean, it's just not.
Yeah, but I don't think of it as a brewed product.
But it is.
But it is. Okay. Because I think my beer is brewed. Do you know what I mean? Sort of what I'm saying is
it's made like all the craft brewery. I was just up at the New Solace brewery that's in Falls Church, or really it's a restaurant that's selling their beers. And they have a seltzer. The DC Brow apparently has a couple of hard seltzers that are well reviewed. I think the folks over by you and what's the name of that place down in Alexandria?
Port City.
Yeah, Port City. I think they have one now. Anyway.
Yeah, don't know. It's interesting. I think there is I definitely see it as a way, as an attempt to, I'm going to say this about myself, to try and sort of cut into like sort of the innate snobbery that someone like I have towards it.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't take it seriously as anything. It's like, I just don't. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I do. I think it's a young people's drink. I think it's, and I know that it's not, but I think it's almost like, it's like it's faux alcohol. It's, you know, do you know what I mean? I just look down on it in a very, mm-hmm. very sort of man of indeterminate middle age turning his nose up to it. So this notion of, you know, Bud Light Platinum and brood and this, it's an attempt to go, look, man of indeterminate middle age, this product is for you.
Coca-Cola is getting into the act now too with a Topo Chico hard seltzer, whatever Topo that Chico. Means.
I don't know. I like the sound of that. That sounds cool. Sounds kind of exotic. I'll have a Topo Chico, please.
There's another line called Social Club. Is another ABN Bev item. So it's from the same folks about, it looks like it's supposed to be sort of like old school social club seltzers, where I think they're like fashioned after old school cocktails. Maybe yeah. Like there's an old fashioned one, a sidecar one, a citrus gimlet one,
which I guess is a
neat. So I guess we could always do another one of these next March. Maybe that'll be a springtime thing by then. Yeah. There'll be 80 different brands.
Probably. I mean, the market will be flooded, and we should do it next March. Cause I'm still one of those people who believes within 3 years, we would have moved on to the next thing.
I would have thought.
I think I may have said that back in the March special. I just think all these things have a very limited lifespan. You know, and everyone thinks it's the next big thing, but it's not. It's just the next big thing until it's not. You know, mm-hmm. There's a reason that when you shop in the aisle, it's beer and wine. You know, they've sort of outlasted it. Do you know what I mean? But anyway, talking of fancy cocktails, just about a couple of weeks ago, Sean Connery was 90, and we were going to talk about that if we'd done a show then, but – I also want to throw in there, because, you know, she's another 60s icon. Dame Diana Rigg passed away this week.
Mm-hmm.
And we have talked about her before. If you go back to, I think maybe 2017, when Patrick McNee, who was TV's original John Steed from the show The Avengers, who was the 60s sort of super sleuth who wore a bowler hat and carried an umbrella, and Diana Rigg, a young Diana Rigg, was one of his TV sidekicks. She played Emma Peel. Then, of course, she then went on to become Mrs. James Bond.
So she wasn't the original in The Avengers, though, right? Nope. Wasn't that Honor Blackman?
Honor Blackman. Well, so I'm a bit of an Avengers geek, as I think I said back then. The Avengers originally was two dudes. And Patrick McNee was the sidekick to another guy. And then the other guy didn't want to be on the show anymore. So then they kept Patrick McNee as John Steed, and they gave him a female sidekick who was Honor Blackman, who of course was Pussy Galore in Goldfinger, with Sean Connery as James Bond.
Yeah. So, but why did, do you know why they changed? Did she bail out and they had to find somebody? Did they get rid of her? Do you know
who, Honor Blackman or Diana Rigg?
Yeah. No, Honor Blackman.
Well, no, Honor Blackman left because she went to go and make the James Bond movie.
Oh,
so
I guess nowadays you wouldn't do that.
But. Yeah. So she left the show. And so then they had to find out, then they looked to replace her, and they replaced her with Diana Rigg. And so Diana Rigg was sort of, I think she was in the like three series or the most episodes. So she is like, she's probably the most well-known of his sidekicks, also because it was around the same time that the show really took off. And then also was also the first time when the show transitioned to color episodes, because it was originally a black and white show and then it became color. And of course she was famous because she was this very sort of late, you know, she drove a sports car and could do karate in the whole nine yards. That sort of boosted her career. So she was on the Avengers for a couple of years, and then she left to go and I think her next big role was, she was in the James Bond movie where she played Mrs. James Bond. She's mm-hmm. the one, she's, and of course, you know, in that way that, I think a lot of these, I don't think it's the case as much now, but I think the case back then where, you know, actors and characters all sort of blended in, do you know what I mean? Sort of in the super 60s, she got known as Mrs. James Bond, even though it was just the part that she played.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was not as, they weren't on Twitter, Instagram, like, and you didn't really know what was going on the rest of the time. She also was, for more recent people.
No, I was going to let you talk about that.
She was the, I forget the first name, Tyrell, who's, she was the older woman, Tyrell, who, was scheming behind the scenes to, deal with Game of Thrones and take over and displace the other family. I forget which. See, it's been so long, but, she's very good in it, but you would barely, like, I wouldn't have connected other than the fact that I saw the listing, because she wears like one of those, kind of almost like a nun type headdress that goes around your side of your head and everything too. So she's just sort of like a face in a big article of clothing, but she was really, really good in that. I mean, that was definitely pretty cool.
So here's an interesting thing to me when she passed away this week, and sort of thinking about her and her career, that, you know, other than being in Honor Majesty's Secret Service, she didn't really have much of like a movie career. So she was known for being on The Avengers on TV. She was known for being Mrs. James Bond. Obviously now later, you know, one of her last big roles was on Game of Thrones, which to be fair is a massive success. So that is the equivalent. You know, I would imagine a Game of Thrones, you know, let's put it this way. Back in the 60s on a Sunday night, The Avengers was Game of Thrones. So that's how big The Avengers was back then. And yet, interestingly, you know, if you look through the rest of her sort of filmography, she really didn't do Hollywood. It's a couple of movies here and there, but she spent a lot of time sort of back on the stage, you know, in New York and back in England. Whereas unlike, you know, some of her contemporaries, I mean, you know, Judi Dench is a couple of years older. And yes, Judi Dench is Shakespearean trained and been on the stage and all sorts. But Judi Dench, you know, she's had a pretty big time. You know, she's won an Oscar or two. She's done movies. Diana Rigg, who was the same age, just, I don't know, it just never seemed to be her thing. And yet She would, you know, she died a Dame Diana Rigg, so that is the female equivalent of being a sir. And of course, you know, in England, she's a legend. And, you know, if you're a dude of a certain age, like I am, you're like, oh, wow, Diana Rigg. I mean, you know, she was a big time sort of star of that sort of swinging 60s era. Do you know what I mean?
Where, she's busy. I'm like, so she's got post Game of Thrones, she's got like 4 different series she worked on. She was in this Victoria TV series, Detectorists.
I guess I wanted to talk about Detectorists in a minute, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's just interesting. It's not like she wasn't doing stuff. It just she's a working actor.
Yeah, and I think she was in like Pygmalion on stage, and you know, she's one of those people who just acted and acted and acted and acted. And she has a daughter called Rachel Sterling, who, you know, she's sort of been on TV and stuff like that. And it's interesting when I see her daughter on TV. It's one of those people where at first I don't realize she's Diana Rigg's daughter. And then when she talks and I watch for 5 minutes, I'm thinking, oh, of course, yeah, she's Diana. I suddenly see her mother in her. Rachel Sterling actually was a co-star in a British comedy from a couple of years ago called The Detectorists. And you can find it on Netflix and also on Apple. It's very, very funny. And it is about these two guys. I think one of the you will recognize both of them when you see them. One guy is Gareth Crook? He was the original, or Mackenzie Crook, who was the original. Oh my gosh, I've forgotten his name now. Who's the character on The Office? Dwight. Yeah. Dwight. So he was the English sort of Dwight on the English Office, and then another actor who I know is familiar to American audiences because he's played Truman Capote. I think he was nominated for an Oscar for that. But anyway, they play these two regular dudes who their hobby is metal detecting. And that's why it's called The Detectorists. And it's really just about them. And it's very dry and very funny. And anyway, Diana Rigg was on that, playing her real daughter's mother on the show. And that even that was only like 4 or 5 years ago. So to your point, she was a, you know, full-on working actress. I mean, you know, Game of Thrones has only been off TV a couple of years, right?
Yeah, no, it hasn't been long.
So yeah, she passed away this week, and I was like, oh, there you go. And I only said that because, you know, I know, we had this discussion when Peter Fonda passed away, and there is that whole these sort of like 60s icons that you know, I think people nowadays. I don't want to. This is probably going to be an unfair comparison I'm going to make, but in the way that certain people have this sort of outsized celebritydom now, like the Kardashians or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting Diana Rigg was that sort of person, but what I'm saying is if you were a TV star or a film star in the 60s, you know, you were known across the world, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So she passed away, and of course she's Mrs. James Bond, but not Sean Connery James Bond. And he was 90 the other week. Kind of blew me away. I didn't realize he was that old.
Yeah, well, he's holding up pretty decently, I guess, for a 90-year-old.
Yeah. So Sean Connery was 90, and I remember when I texted you that, you were like, "Yeah, I watched Zardos," which is one of the few Sean Connery movies I haven't watched.
And it looks funny. Like it's available on Amazon. I was checking it again while we're here, so I think you could get it off of Amazon and stream it. But Zardos is like a sci-fi Irish-American sci-fi movie from 1974 starring him and a number of other folks. I won't get into too much detail, but
is Raquel Welsh in that?
No, it's
someone.
Where the heck is the names?
There's a big time, like, sort of, again, talking of like 60s actress icons. There's someone who's his psychic in that. I wish I could remember who it was.
Yeah, it's a couple of former models and where is it? Anyway, I'll find it as we're going through this stuff. But it's super duper like psychedelic, freaky weirdness, like oddball colors, and like it's some future society where he's like he kills people for this floating head, which is really run by like this uber race of or segment of population that like are ageless and they basically are penalized by becoming older. And then there's this like room full of all the old versions of people dressed in like aristocratic clothes. And it's very weird. There's a lot of topless women and things. And I think, you know, it's in 74. I think this is It was a little bit of a weird wave of sci-fi stuff after 2001. I think this is in it. I mean, the funniest thing is he's almost the whole time he's wearing this like red bandoliers and like, yeah. It's like a diaper bikini, you know, it's not even like a full shorts and thigh high boots, and they ride around horses on that stuff.
It's like a male thong or something, yeah. But it's got kind of belts across his naked chest and all sorts of things.
You
said that about like early 70s science fiction. It really ran the gamut from
some, you know, it's a little like Barbarella.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. I think that way.
Because again, I mean,
in the future, Earth is ruled by Eternals, an advanced and secret sect of beings who rule over a savage group called Brutals. The Eternals have created a god named Zardoz to intimidate the Brutals, making them believe that killing is their natural state. And this guy, he plays Zed. Charlotte Rampling, Sarah Kesselman. It was actually directed by the guy, John Boorman, who directed his movie right before that was Deliverance.
Yeah.
It seems like a joke or something, but it's, you know, they took it seriously and they were going after something. Like, it's almost like a weird European art movie, like, you know.
Well, interesting.
It looks stupid in retrospect. But
you mentioned John Boorman's name, and he did Deliverance. And then a couple of years later, of course, he made Excalibur.
Yeah.
He was the director of Excalibur, which I still think is, again, that all like King Arthur stuff is not really my thing. But when that movie comes on, I always sit and watch that. I'm like, do you know what I mean? I always think that's a very good telling of all that sort of stuff. Zardoz, and of course, it's interesting though, because it was in the 70s that when he wasn't Bond, you know, Connery, he did a lot of movies that you go, ooh, those things are dogs. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, and again, I mean, his career sort of wandered around until, I mean, basically, he sort of had that second go after The Untouchables.
I was going to say The Untouchables was a big thing that sort of turned him into the older, wise, you know, expert in something, you know. It's not like anybody has really accused him of being a great actor. I mean, a star, you know, but he's not a great actor. So, like, the fact that he was cast and he was doing a bunch of different things, it's not too surprised. Outland.
Which is actually a movie I like a lot.
Yeah, Outland's pretty good.
I mean, that's
Highlander, you know, of course.
And then he ended up doing, he did The Untouchables, and then he was, of course, in The Hunt for Red October, and he sort of had that sort of quick rebirth. He's actually also around that same time as Zardoz. He's in A Bridge Too Far. And he's got like the biggest part in A Bridge Too Far, which is full of stars, like Robert Redford's in it, Gene Hackman's in it, Michael Caine's in it, but Sean Connery pretty much has, and a very young Anthony Hopkins, who at that time was not a star. Connery has a big part in that movie, but yeah, his career sort of wandered around a few things. The two of my favorite films are his, and sort of taking this notion of sort of Zardoz being slightly off the beaten path. There's two films I always recommend to people to watch of Sean Connery. One is The Hill, which was in the 1960s, and it is about British soldiers in a garrison, and it's like this psychological battle between a very nasty prison guard and Sean Connery's character. That's a movie that I recommend. And then there's another one, and it was part of the deal that when he came back to do James Bond in Diamonds Are Forever, Connery was very big on making sure he got paid. And that was why he stopped being James Bond, because he felt like he wasn't being paid enough. So when he came back after Honor Majesty's Secret Service with the other guy who marries Diana Rigg, Connery took the people to town. And United Artists, the studio, were like, pay him whatever he wants. He needs to be James Bond. And so he got a couple of other films funded as part of his deal. One of those films is a film called The Offense. And it's this very low-key drama about a policeman in a small Scottish town tracking down the murderer of someone who's killed a schoolgirl. And it all comes down to this sort of interrogation where he completely loses, you know, his self-control and his rage and everything. And, you know, it's very, very small movie, made like $20, but very good performance by him all from that time. But yeah, Sean Connery, 90.
Yeah.
Which did surprise me. I feel like he's one of those dudes, I think because he sort of aged, it's hard to think of him as 90. I just think of him as later. Do you know what I mean? Like, we talked about the Untouchables. So, like, it's like he reached, he became, there's James Bond Sean Connery, and then there's Untouchables Sean Connery. And so within those two eras, 80, 90, it don't mean anything to me. It's Untouchables Sean Connery.
Yeah.
I think that's your show.
Yeah, I think so. I was about to mention, just in terms of movies, they just delayed Wonder Woman's public release to Christmas. So it's really throwing off our summer preview testing, because we won't even be able to like figure out the revenues.
Well, and apparently too, the studio is being very coy about the amount of money Tenet is bringing in. Like, there are a whole load of first weekend numbers. Nobody's going to
theaters. There's no theaters open in New York City or in California. So the one thing they said is, because Wonder Woman's delayed, Tenet's just going to hang around the theaters for the next 3 months.
Well, there's nothing else on, is there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So.
James Bond's still scheduled with the new guy, the last film with the new guy. Yeah. You say new guy because Sean Connery's 90, with Daniel Craig. That is still scheduled for November. And I guess Wonder Woman is now Christmas. The Bill and Ted movie went straight to video on demand. So, apparently, it was very well reviewed, though.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, I don't know what we're going to do. Pick a winner. Maybe one of those years where we have no choice but to call a draw.
Mm-hmm.
Or we'll just
delay. I'll check ahead of time and make sure that's worthwhile.
Yeah. I mean, it won't change the fact that your notes are probably a mess, but there you go.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so there's your whole load of links that will be on the blog. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. We do have to figure out what we're doing over the next few weeks. Apparently, we have been asked to go on the road to meet people who are keeping chickens. So let me look into that.
You said something about cheese tasting. I don't know what ever happened to that. You're supposed to show up at my door with a bunch of cheese.
Yeah, let's do that. We'll do some cheese tasting.
All right.
We'll have to be in the same room, though, if different ends of the same room. or maybe we can do it from a boat.
Yeah.
Or the cockpit of our A350. This has been the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
I'm Eric. Take care.
You've just enjoyed Eric and Zeph on the Atlantic Voice Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at @Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at Libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at AtlanticVoice.net. Email us at AtlanticVoice@gmail.com. And now on YouTube, search for the Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.